up, America. It's time for Michael Dean After Dark. I'm your host, Michael Dean, Freedom Fiend, and this is the Late Night Feisty Liberty Show. We have a rotating stable of interesting insomniac co-hosts. Plus, we leave the phone lines open. So if the hamster in your brain is keeping you up, please call in.
Yes, people. This is Michael Dean After Dark. I am your host, Michael Dean. And we got a special feisty rotating spinning co-host tonight, Mike Makes Right. How you doing there, Mike?
What's up, buddy? How's it going?
It's going good. It's going real good. And we've known each other for about 15 years. Well, tell me just briefly who you are and what you're about. What makes you tick?
Well, I am a libertarian and
we met.
Yeah, I'm one of those. And we met way back in, I think, 1997. And we both shared a passion for loud music and voluptuous women, and we've been friends ever since.
Yep, that's the kind of show this is. It's I do a more family friendly show on the weekends. It's called The Freedom Fiends, which is also a libertarian, we don't like the government show. And actually, this show, Michael Dean After Dark, is going to be a little bit more, you know, most radio that's political is complaining and going, the government. And actually, other than this show, the flagship, pilot show tonight, which is going to complain about the government, but actually we're just making fun of it and laughing at it. This show in general is going to be a little more like what the world would be like if the government just left everyone alone and dissolved. And, you know, we have a theory that the government isn't going to become more tyrannical. It is, but it's going to be more like it's going to kind of become like MySpace. Like, it's still going to have 200 million users, but they haven't logged in 6 years. And that's what we're hoping. So this is going to be the show that's going to be kind of like what it's like in in libertarian paradise. You know, if you didn't have the government to complain about anymore, like the fun stuff you'd talk about. It's also going to be kind of the journalism school, the radio classes for the next generation of liberty who will replace me when whatever the government's feeding me, you know, secretly makes me too senile to be on the air. I want to have like 40 people trained to take my place, because either in 5 years, when that happens, either they're going to outlaw radio, so we're all going to have to go to the internet. So we'll need like 40 more people for, you know, the Freedom Fiends streaming radio show on .bit networks through meowbit.com. Or the government will just be so, like, you know, like MySpace, and no one uses it anymore, that like talk radio, instead of being all these Republicans and Democrats screaming at each other, it'll be kind of like this. So in that case, we'll also need 40 new trained hosts to take over. So, Mike, we used to live in San Francisco together, and then we wised up. We lived in a neighborhood called the Tenderloin. Tell us a little about the Tenderloin, and do you know why it's called the Tenderloin?
Yes, I do. Well, the Tenderloin is this interesting district in San Francisco that, how should I say, very colorful district.
It's Skid Row, man. Just say Skid Row.
It's basically where you can get any drug known to mankind. And
for food stamps,
it's where a lot of poor people live, and it's pretty much where the bulk of the prostitution happens. And in fact, the Tenderloin, if I'm not mistaken, is named because it was the place where you could get the choicest cuts of meat. A lot of people think it's named after a certain type of prostitute or prostitutes, but
or an act,
it's actually about meat.
I actually heard it was because in the days of the Barbary Coast, a good tenderloin slight cut of meat, you know, a steak, was the price to bribe a cop in that neighborhood to not arrest you or to look the other way if you were committing crimes.
I wouldn't be surprised. With Emperor Norton at the helm, that's probably true.
Yeah, Emperor Norton. Yeah, he was a homeless person who declared himself emperor, and people took him seriously. And that people tell that, like, that's how colorful San Francisco is. They, like, let a homeless bum crazy guy be mayor, and they did.
Right. 10,000 people went to his funeral. Did you know that?
Yeah, I did. There's also a statue of him right below 600 Montgomery, the pyramid.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a post office in this neighborhood. It's at, I believe, 101 Hyde, which is what? Hyde and what? We were bike messengers. You should know
that
when it was.
That might be Hyde and Golden Gate.
That sounds right. Yeah. Yep, right up the street from the Golden Gate Gym where I used to work out, which is it's literally the gayest gym in the world, and I'm not gay. And I'm not saying that in any bad way. It's just literally the gayest.
There's nothing wrong with that.
The gayest gym in the world. It's kind of annoying to be constantly propositioned by old men when you're just there to work out. And I went there because it was some kind of program where if you didn't make much money, you could have a gym membership there for $11 a month. So I went to Skid Row and worked out. And this post office became my post office because I used to have a P.O. box at 7th and Market in this glorious old beautiful building that was damaged by the earthquake in, when was that, 89? Were you there then?
No, but yes, it was in 89.
That's yeah, correct. And it cracked the foundation. So all of a sudden, if you couldn't use that post office anymore, and if you had a post office box there, you suddenly automatically had a post office 8 blocks away at this really horrible, scary post office at 101 Hyde. And we would like to read some reviews of the post office of this post office, Civic Center Post Office Box Unit on Yelp.com. It's at 101 Hyde, Golden Gate and Turk, between Golden Gate and Turk. And it is, you know, when I was going there, there wasn't a web to review it on, but I wish there had been. So let's just read through these, man, and then we'll talk about the post office in general.
So George P. from Longmont, Colorado says, if you have ever found yourself in another post office saying, this is the worst post office I've ever been in the world, I can 100% guarantee you have not been to this post office.
The next one says, the one employee here who looks like a model train enthusiast, maybe it was Satoshi. The guy they thought was Satoshi was a libertarian gun nut Californian computer programming model train enthusiast. If you're unfortunate as to have your package end up at this post office, you're really better writing it off than wasting your time trying to retrieve it. Once you accept the fact that you're never getting your hands on it, you can simply have the item resent through a functioning package delivery system such as UPS, FedEx, DHL, etc. Dealing with the Civic Center post office is like living in a Kafka novel, but with bums and flies everywhere.
I can corroborate the flies. Yes, yeah. That post office definitely had a large influx of flies every single time I went into there. And it was over the course of years. It wasn't like it was just a week and they got rid of the flies.
I mean, every town has, you know, kind of a skid row, and every town has a place where, you know, downtrodden men and the occasional woman are, you know, without homes and, you know, wearing their winter clothes year round because they don't want it to get stolen. But this place makes the average Skid Row look like, you know, a decent middle class neighborhood. I used to be a heroin addict, and I saw some heroin use in front of this post office that made my jaw drop. This was shortly after I got clean, about 20 years ago. I was riding my bike by this post office, like literally in front of this post office, you know, 10 feet away from the building or 7 feet away from the building. I saw a junkie in broad daylight sticking a needle in his arm, not using a tourniquet. He was using one of the telephone poles right in front of this. No, parking meter right in front of the post office as a tourniquet, like pushing his arm out at arm's length up against it to like tie off a vein and then sticking a needle in it. Broad daylight, man.
Yeah,
mind blowing.
The desperation was palpable for sure.
Yes. Yeah, Kafka novel, but with, you know, used syringes you have to be careful not to step on when you're wearing sneakers.
I have to say the only 5-star review this place has is
from a postal worker.
It's from Michael Z in San Francisco, and he says they're painting a mural on this formal black hole. Yay! Yay!
I thought that was sarcastic, but it does have 5. Yeah, that's government work for you. It's like, in, you know, something is not working. It's a monopoly. No competition can come in and fix it. And what the government does is hires someone to paint a colorful mural on the side of it.
Yeah, and they don't hire somebody on the cheap either. Those people get paid a handsome salary to do that type of work.
Yeah.
That's something that you could not get in the private sector for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of the private sector, if this place were a restaurant, it would have been condemned and the government would have bulldozed it and burned it to the ground years ago. In the absence of a government, in a truly free market, if this were a restaurant, it would have gone out of business 20 years ago with reviews like this, man.
if you look at the reviews, they go back to 2008. So we've had 6 years of almost every single review is a one star, and there is just no way.
Well, I think that's since Yelp started, man. Right. I was complaining to people about this place literally like 21 years ago to anyone who would listen.
Yeah. There was reviews pre-Yelp, for sure.
Because the thing was, like, okay, I had a post office box at this really nice post office box place, but the earthquake destroyed it. So the waiting list for a post office box in San Francisco is like 27 months or something. So I didn't want to get another one, and I didn't want to get one of those, you know, fly-by-night kind of like goes out of business kind of places either. So I just suffered through this place. I don't know. I think it was inertia, man. I should have gotten, you know, post boxes or us or something, but...
Well, yeah. The thing too that people need to realize is that this is people. We're not using this as a marker for all post office. I'm sure there are some nice ones out there, but I have to say that I've been into a lot of other post office in the Tenderloin and in San Francisco, and they're not much better.
They're not as bad.
Exactly.
I think this is the post office where they punish postal workers who are particularly bad at other post offices. Seriously, because like. At other post offices, you know, they have some of the problems that this one has, but you can actually get service. I mean, literally, you can't mail a package at this place. And they have postal, like, they have stamp machines that, according to this, have been out of business, you know, like, broken with a sign on them saying, like, will be fixed for, like, 6 years. But that's just after Yelp started, because it was like that for 6 years before that, at least.
I wouldn't be surprised, too, because it's hard to get fired as a postal worker. It's a public sector union that represents them. So you have to do something incredible to stop working for the post office.
No,
so
they just send you here to punish you.
Yeah,
and then exactly. And then after 6 months, you're like, I'll be good. And then they send you back right. to another one and send someone right. else who's mean here. All right. That's some bomb we're listening to there. We'll be back with more on Michael Dean After Dark. This is Michael Dean After Dark, and we're discussing the incompetence that occurs in monopolies like the post office, and in particular, the Civic Center Post Office Box Unit and the reviews on Yelp. You used to live in this neighborhood, Mike, and I used
That's
to
right.
have a P.O. box at this post office. So if anyone wants to call in and tell us about government incompetence, the number is 1-855-660-4261. That's 1-855-660-4261. Now, Mike makes right. Do you want to read a couple more of these, or do you have another story to tell about this neighborhood and this post office?
Yeah, we can read a couple more reviews, but I also want to point out, too, that this is the post office that is as close, I think, to the worst corner in San Francisco, which is Jones and Eddy, and that is just the biggest outdoor drug market bazaar probably in the world,
which doesn't necessarily, you know, we're not anti-drug and we're not anti-drug no. market, but in the presence of a drug war, the drug market gets pushed to the worst neighborhood and makes it far worse.
Right. I yeah. mean, it just turns it to the lowest of the low.
It's also, interestingly, I believe, the closest post office to the federal building over on Golden Gate.
Oh, yeah.
Where the FBI is.
That's correct.
Worst service. Okay, here's one. Heather H. from San Francisco says, and these are all one star, and some people complain that they had to even give it one star to review it. Worst service I've ever had in my entire life. No help whatsoever and extremely rude on the phone. Called to track down a package since the other post office numbers weren't working. They said, "Why are you calling here?" and then rudely hung up. Welcome to San Francisco. My recommendation, FedEx.
Emily S. from San Francisco says, "It's all true. This place is pretty much a stinkhole. It smells really bad all the time. Thick bum soaked in urine for 3 weeks meets a pack of alley cats. The flies are pretty annoying, too. That Man. Said, the location near Civic Center is convenient for me, and, well, they put my mail in the right box. I guess that's going to have to do."
the other thing that we're omitting here is that part of the reason – You know, blaming the state again for the state of the state and the state making the state worse and the state of the state is that this is also general delivery for this whole part of San Francisco. So if you are a homeless person who does not have a residence, this is where you pick up your welfare check or your SSI check. So it is that's pretty much why this place still exists, other than just inertia, other than, you know, there's some government spreadsheet somewhere that allocates stolen funds and want, you know, they allocate probably $1 million a year to keep this black hole of this black sewer of Calcutta with a really nice mural on the outside going.
Well, you know, I also think, too, this has a lot to do with this mentality in San Francisco where they truly do coddle the poor. I would say it's probably easier to get a welfare benefits in San Francisco than pretty much any other place. And that's not to say that there aren't homeless people that do need these kinds of things. But this is kind of that culture of San Francisco where it's the victim mentality, you know, oh, no, don't work. Let somebody else pay for you. Well, this is what you get when you democratize. They love that word.
Yeah.
Democratize institutions, and you get the lowest of the low. You get to see it.
It's also kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy a continuing spiral down the drain, because this is a fact. This was told to me by somebody who was on welfare in San Francisco who heard it from their social worker. If you're on welfare in a place where they don't like welfare as much, like, Kentucky or Alabama or Louisiana or Florida, and, you know, you're freezing and trying to sleep outside and they arrest you and then they put you through the social worker system and you end up back in the welfare department. The welfare, before they'll try to find you a house, they will give you an option. They'll say, we'll try to find you housing, but it'll take a while. Or we will right now give you a one-way bus ticket to San Francisco and $10 a day for food right. for the trip.
Right.
Seriously.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it weeds out the people that really don't need this, who are just trying to game the system.
Yeah. There you go. California, where the streets are paved with flies and I don't even want to say on the radio what else, apparently.
Bump-soaked urine.
Bump-soaked alley cat urine. Aw, the poor kitties. I'm so glad that my kitties don't live on the street in San Francisco. I mean, actually, there are, you know, feral cats here in Casper, Wyoming, and they're pretty sturdy. They make it through the bitter winters here, some of them. And I've seen ones that have been – I tried to adopt them, and they're just like – they hiss at me and bite me, and they don't want to be helped. So, you know, I don't. But they probably do better than a cat living in the Tenderloin. It would probably get right. shot for sport. You know, it's or eaten or just abused. And we're really glad that the social services of San Francisco take such good care of people who don't want to work. We'll be back with more on Michael Dean After Dark after this. You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and yes, we're broadcasting this message into space. You've read books, attended lectures, and you know the Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing. Buttons! Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed, buy sheep for sheep on sheep, and two designs for the Freedom Fiends. Wear them with pride. Use them to start conversations with statists. It's only $10 for 10 buttons, including shipping. Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and this is Michael Dean. It is definitely After Dark. And if you want to call in, the call-in number is 1-855-660-4261. That's 1-855-660-4261. And we're talking about the monopoly of the post office. My friend Mike Makes Right and I, we used to live 15 years ago in San Francisco, right next to this post office that's being reviewed on Yelp. You know, it's interesting, all these bad reviews. A lot of these people's icon is a picture of them eating. Is that just what people do in San Francisco, or is that what Yelp is in San Francisco? Yeah.
I mean, you can't throw a rock without hitting a restaurant in San Francisco. They're everywhere.
But
so
don't
I'm
try.
Not surprised. Yeah.
We're not recommending that.
We like restaurants.
Yeah, we do. We like the free market. And
right.
Yeah, you know, actually, I used to have this broken TV. It was like a portable TV that ran on batteries for about 10 minutes until it would die. And it weighed about 12 pounds. It was an old portable TV that you tuned it like a radio. It didn't click from one channel to the other. It tuned like, you know, a dot, like a, you know, you could get between the channels kind of. And if you took it all the way over to the left, like past the channels back, this is when they actually had cellular phones, you know, cell phones, as opposed to the new technology they have now. I actually could pick up cell phones for a couple blocks anywhere near where I lived. And I lived at Bush and Powell, which is the Tender Knob. It's halfway between right. the Tenderloin and Knob Hill. And there's a lot of traffic around there. So I would hear a lot of phone calls. And really, I was kind of dismayed to find out that it's pretty boring to accidentally bug people's phone calls, because most of what people talk about, at least in San Francisco, is what they're going to eat for dinner, what they just ate, or what they're planning to eat tomorrow.
Right. Yeah, that is the culture for sure. Although, again, like back to the Tenderloin, it's an anomaly even in San Francisco. If you've ever seen, there's a documentary about prostitution in the Tenderloin. Well, the block that I used to live on was prominently displayed. And in fact, a buddy of mine that lived in the same building, he came out one time and was actually propositioned by an undercover cop. And he said, "No, thank you, officer." Like, made it very clear that he knew what was up. Well, he got tackled by a bunch of cops. Ugh. And he got roughed up and basically was told, like, if you ever try to pull that ever again, you're going to be in big trouble. So
they're just a bunch of bullies, man, who have different rules than you, because they could do that all day long. They could go up to somebody and like start screaming and pointing at someone and saying, "He's a drug dealer. He deals drugs. He doesn't have any on him now, but I know he's a drug dealer." They could do that all day long. I mean, actually, you know, if they did it to a gang member, they might get some retaliation back. But yeah, they can do it. Everything they do, they, you know, they lie to you in interrogation, and it's a crime to lie to them even by accident. And they try to trip you up so you will lie by accident, so they can use it against you to make you do whatever they want.
Right. Well, you know, I lived right by an alley too there that a lot of people would take one of these street walking cheetahs to the back alley and, you know, they would do their business back there. And, you know, I knew that when I moved there. So it wasn't like I would see these people and have disdain for them. Like I was young and silly, and that kind of stuff didn't bother me. And that's kind of like a lot of people.
And you were probably writing a novel, and it was research.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's like I really didn't have the right to complain, you know, and I find it interesting that of all places, the Tenderloin, prostitution isn't legal.
Well, speaking about like moving into something and complaining, one of my favorite rock clubs in that city, the I-Beam, where my band Bomb used to play all the time.
Great place.
Great place, great room, held about 600-700 people, good lines of sight, really good sound system, good security that wasn't out to break bones but would actually help break up fights. And just, you know, they treated bands well, paid them well, gave them drinks, gave them dinner sometimes. And that place got closed down because this gay couple, doesn't matter that they're gay, other than that there's nobody as self-righteous as some of the gay men with money in San Francisco. Did you experience that ever?
Well, it's also just a lot of self-righteousness comes from people that haven't they've spent 1 year in San Francisco, and they feel that it's their duty to stand up for the neighborhood.
Yeah, it's also kind of like people move there who've been oppressed everywhere for being gay, which is, it's bad to be oppressed for being gay, but then you move to San Francisco where it's celebrated to the point where it's in law that you have to celebrate it, and like you can't be mayor without being in the gay parade and things like that. Right. To where like it's like, yeah, I'm it's beyond we're here, we're queer, get used to it. It's like, you know, we're entrenched and we're on the city council and we'll destroy you if you don't do what we say. But this couple moved in above the I-Beam and complained about the music until it got shut down. Can you believe that?
No, I can't believe it, because it was a great place. I mean, so many bands got their break at the IBM in San Francisco. So Faith No More, Primus, all. I mean, I'm sure Bomb had a big break there as well. So it just to interfere with culture in such a way to assert, you know, your nanny state nonsense is just despicable.
I saw one of the coolest shows in my life I ever saw at the IBM. It was Screamin' Jay Hawkins. Man, talk about putting on a good weird show.
Yeah, that guy was great.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny, San Francisco is just one thing I'll say is that when I initially moved there in like 1992, I moved there because it was one of the cheapest places to live.
Yeah, and man. I was paying.
Quickly, within 7 years, it was like the most expensive place.
Well, when I moved there, I was paying $180 a month for rent for my own room in a shared house with a bunch of other weirdos. I was working 10 hours a week as a bar back in the hippest bar in town. You know, like, I mean, I remember it was a bar that it was the Covered Wagon. It held like 99 people. And I remember, you know, getting paid $10 an hour to go out and put up flyers for Nirvana playing in a place that was the size of my current living room, literally. And it was good times, man. And then the .com thing happened and it just destroyed the ability to live cheap in San Francisco. And then, like, you know, the rents went up like 16-fold on everything. And all the poor people moved to Oakland or went back to wherever they were from. And I was rent controlled, so I stayed where I was and dug in. And then after the .com bust, you know, after like they realized that you can't scribble a business plan on a napkin to sell, you know, pianos over the internet and deliver them through the U.S. mail. And, you know, get 10 million in funding or, you know, 100 million in funding, when those places went out of business and it was just the ones that really provided a service like Twitter or Amazon were still around. The landlords just would not reduce the rent for years. Right. Like, they didn't respond to market initiative, partially because of rent control, because it'd been so expensive and that a lot of them had paid, you know, people $30,000 to move out of a $600 a month studio apartment.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember people talking about looking at a potential place to rent, and they would show up and they'd be like, oh, great, we're the first people here. And then they'd find out that a bunch of other people had come before them and offered to pay the first year's rent all up front. And it's like, how do you compete with that? Wow. So you could just see the market dynamic changing. But in a lot of ways, San Francisco is kind of a manufactured city. You know, if there wasn't any rent control, you wouldn't get the weirdos. It would just be all for tech people, which is not a bad thing. But it's interesting because San Francisco really does try to force the artistic and the colorful side. And it's like, that's all done by force.
Literally to the point where one of the many taxes there that don't exist in other cities is there's a 1% extra tax on hotel rooms that every cent of it, other than whatever the bureaucrats steal off the top, it all goes to public art. And the public art in San Francisco is generally really abstract, really ugly, really socialist, or if it's representational and not abstract, is like celebrating the lesbian left-handed Lithuanian laundry workers of the Tenderloin, you know, like some like redemptive, like women struggling against a mountain, like, you know, raising the flag of Iwo Jima, but it's a laundry line, things like that. And it's ridiculous. And it's best summed up by the piece of corporate art. It's actually not, well, you know, there's really not that much difference between corporatist corporations that are not free markets like Bank of America and governments. They're pretty much the same thing. So
the banker's heart.
Banker's heart, man. In front of 555 California. If you search, go on Wikipedia sometime and search 555 California. There's a Wikipedia page for the Bank of America world headquarters in San Francisco. And there's a piece of art in front of it that the bike messengers dubbed Banker's Heart. It is a large, black, cold piece of stone, and it probably weighs about 7 tons. It's bigger than a Toyota pickup truck, and it's polished to a sheen, and somebody was paid millions of dollars probably to make this monstrosity, and it's one of the ugliest pieces of art I've ever seen. That thing they painted on the black hole of Calcutta post office actually was kind of pretty. It's kind of socialist, but it was kind of pretty. You know, it's bright colors, and it was well done. But, yeah, man, Banker's Heart looks like, you know, Mr. Burns would have commissioned it.
I'll give credit to the bankers in one aspect. At least they're being true to their their roots. I mean, the sunshiny and the handholding of the San Francisco people is a little bit manufactured.
Yeah. So. It's not actually called Banker's Heart, though.
Right.
It's got some ridiculous name.
It might as well be.
Yeah, Banker's Heart. Oh, it's called Transcendence. Of course it is. So let's read another one of these wonderful reviews. Sure.
Jason B. has it nice and succinct. He says, "Avoid like the plague. There's never anyone working here. It smells horrible. You actually can't mail anything."
Yes. And yeah. And that's the thing you find out after you wait in line for 2 hours behind, you know, junkies vomiting and alcoholics shooting up. Here's one. Sophie T, who's eating a pork chop in her picture in a restaurant. It says, "This place is located at the Crackhead Central." At the Crackhead Central. "I hate walking in there. It's so dim and ugly. There's flies everywhere. It's gross. The old man that works there is pretty slow, but I think he's like the only one that..." This girl writes like young people talk. "He's like the only one that works at the counter all the way to the left. He's very nice, though, just a little slow. But hey, they should at least clean this place up or something."
I like how she leaves a little bit of positivity there, that he's a nice guy, as if that means anything.
Yeah. Well, it's a redemption in the third act. She's a good storyteller. Okay. Right. This one's mind-blowing. "There was a large swastika drawn on the wall a few months ago. I told Doug at the booth about it, and he just shrugged his shoulders. If there was a swastika painted on any other government building, it'd be gone by after lunch, man. The other people in line also thought this was horrible. I finally had to call the station manager, and after about 2 months, it was painted over. Here's the number you might want to call to complain. And if you want to call and complain to Mike and I, our number is 855-660-4261. That's 1-855-660-4261 on Michael Dean After Dark.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
This is Michael Dean After Dark on the radio with Mike Makes Right. How you doing, Mike?
Hey.
Yeah. So we're going to finish up this first hour. Second hour, we're going to talk about big women and how they help keep you sober. And the first hour, we're talking about the post office, and in particular, this is like the ultimate post office in America, the Civic Center San Francisco one. Let me read one last review, and then you can read one. "Worst service ever. Avoid at all costs. I tried to give it 0 stars and found out it's not possible. 0 stars should be possible for a place like this." So you got one?
Yes. Meg R. says, -5 stars. "Avoid this place at all costs." That's a very popular thing to say in these reviews.
Avoid.
"A friend of mine sent me 3 packages and I forgot to tell her to send them to my office or via UPS because my packages addressed to my house automatically reroute here." And she says, "What might seem a perfectly hilarious SNL skit was probably the most frustrating 30 minutes of my life."
I just searched the word avoid and kept hitting enter, and it occurs in 8 of these 20 reviews, the word avoid. Yeah, man. So I really think that pretty soon every government building in America will be like this. The thing is, though, they'll still have laws to prevent you from competing directly with things like this.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's one thing that drives me crazy about the post office. You hear a lot of statists, particularly liberals, say, "Well, didn't you know that back in 1980, blah, the post office no longer takes taxpayer money?" And so they try to make that as a virtue. It's so hidden. I mean, look at any of the implicit subsidies. I mean, the post office, they never get any parking tickets. And if you've ever gone to downtown San Francisco, I can guarantee you that FedEx and UPS probably pays millions.
Well, you worked for UPS and FedEx, didn't you?
Exactly.
And they compete. They work hard. You've never seen a postal worker work fast the way that those guys do. Yeah.
No. When I used to work for those companies, I was in fear for my life because they would yell at you if you were not working fast enough.
Because they're in competition, and only with one other company. That's so much competition, man.
Right. And they can't even deliver.
There is other competition. When I sent you the microphone you're using, remember we had a tracking number for it and it was like something we'd never heard of, man, but it got there. What was it? Do you remember?
Maybe it was like, I don't know. Maybe DHL.
It was not DHL. It was something I'd never, ever heard of, but it worked. It got there. So yeah.
Well, the post office gets the monopoly on the first class mail. So
right.
That's
right.
One
the letters
crowd out. Right.
Yeah. Well, you can actually still send first class mail, but you have to charge more than the post office. Right. That's the law. Sure. That's the Lysander Spooner law.
Right.
And, yeah, man. They also the biggest thing with the post office is the American taxpayers guarantee the pensions of those guys. And those guys retire. They've been retiring a lot of them early, like paying them to retire at like 46 and stuff lately. I have a friend that retired at 46 and bought a house with his pension from the post office from being a mailman for like 12 years or something.
Right. It's not the hardest job.
Nah, man. And I like my postal carrier. He's the nicest government employee I've ever met. He's really friendly and he does a good job. He's not a drunk like the one I had in California. He doesn't deliver my mail to my neighbor and vice versa. But more and more, like, he's delivering junk mail and that's it, because everything else is done electronically. And this poor guy, I mean, I guess I shouldn't feel sorry for him. He's probably going to retire, you know, at 50 at my age with like a lot of money. But Wyoming, you know, the through the snow, sleet, and dead of night, try that in Wyoming, man. It gets to like 30 below here with like 50 mile an hour wind. And I see this poor guy, he's like 55, trudging through this weather and then coming up to my house to like put one thing in my mailbox. And, you know, 4 days out of five, it's like a flyer from a used car company in town that I'm never going to visit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just seems like a lot of wasted productivity. You know, you wonder if people like that worked in some other private sector job. Yeah, where people actually wanted their services. What kind of world would we be living in if we actually had people that provided services that we wanted?
One of my favorite things I actually ever saw, well, it wasn't that cool. It was a guy getting arrested for weed at a Grateful Dead show in the parking lot. I didn't go in. I just went to the parking lot at, you know, Berkeley at the Greek. And when he was getting arrested, though, there was a black dreadlocked Jamaican dude like screaming at the cops going, "Come down to my office Monday morning. I give you honest work selling incense." We'll be back for hour two of Michael Dean After Dark real soon.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark. Go to michaelwdean.com. That's michaelwdean.com.
Good evening, my fellow
worms. I know some things.
I'll be back with more later on.
You're never satisfied.
This is Michael Dean After Dark.
The stato sperimentato.
I don't know
what I'm saying.
The United States government presents
no vision. Congrats.
Not having enough money.
The power was so great.
Esto por su parte considera
to provide guidance to mankind.
Go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. We'll be back for hour two after this trip to the market on Michael Dean After Dark.
Bye for now.
MeowBit is free software from the Freedom Fiends that allows you to effortlessly view .bit websites. MeowBit works on all browsers. .bit is a new type of web address that's not controlled by any government or corporation. And we'll show you how to register a .bit domain today using a few cents worth of Namecoin. If anyone ever shuts down your .com website, users will still be able to get to your site using your .bit address in our free software, MeowBit. Go to meowbit.com. That's MeowBit.com. Yeah, this is Michael Dean, and this is Michael Dean After Dark with my friend Mike Makes Right.
Hey,
how are you doing? Did you survive did you survive not talking for 8 minutes?
Yeah, I was just reading that Jimmy Wales, the creator of Wikipedia. He's been playing with Bitcoin. He just bought some Bitcoin today. Yeah. So look out, world.
Yeah.
Wikipedia taking Bitcoin.
Him probably buying Wikipedia is probably like, well, you know, I sold a few of my properties in villas in Spain. And no, I don't know that he's rich. I don't know. I just assume that everybody who's a name in internetness just has some like anonymous benefactor giving them millions of gold bars.
Yeah,
probably not.
Every great man is Peter Thiel.
So we were talking in the first segment about
San Francisco and drug addicts and the Tenderloin and the post office at 101 Hyde Street and the whole neighborhood. And I think we want to kind of segue into some redemption in the second and third act. But first, we got to get worse because, you know, in the second act of what it was like, what happened and what it's like now, you got to go to hell before you can get to heaven. So let's talk a little bit more about that neighborhood and the denizens of it. Do you have any good stories? I have one good story. Well, you think of another one. I saw a man, broad daylight, standing in the middle of Jones Street. And Jones is well-named because it's a drug addict street and people Jones for drugs. And right up the street is Sucker Punch Park, as my friend Bean called it, because he got sucker punched twice and mugged buying drugs there. And, you know, people might be tuning in going like, what are these guys talking? Why are they talking about this? And it's like, we want to talk about getting away from this and the redemption and how it can be done without the state and without being paid to be sober like a lot of people in San Francisco. So I saw this guy standing in the middle of the street with fistfuls of baggies of crack. This is when it came in baggies. It's so long ago. Like little tiny bags. Waving it in the air, screaming, I got your Jenny Crack weight loss program right here. Jenny Crack, guaranteed weight loss. Yeah, man.
Wow. Yeah, I had I was saying earlier that I lived in the Tenderloin, and my rear window to my apartment faced an alleyway. Well, let's just say I had a television, but I didn't watch it very often because I could see people going back there, and some of the things that I saw were the weirdest drug behavior. In fact, one time I saw a guy, he must have either really dropped something in this dirt patch or didn't, but thought he did. And he was picking through dirt looking for his crack or his meth or whatever it was. And he was doing that for about 30 minutes, and I got a little bored watching him. So I decided to take a shower, called a friend on the phone. And then about 2 hours later, I look out the window, and this poor guy is still sifting through dirt trying to find his lost drugs. And I just, wow, the dedication.
Yeah, that reminds me of something they tell you when you first walk into NA, which is, insanity is trying the same things over and over and expecting different results. And that guy had a PhD in doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, man.
I feel really bad for people like that. Like, you know, whatever drugs I've ever done in the past, I have never been at that level, just completely disconnected from reality.
You know, it's kind of amazing to me how many people in recovery in San Francisco that we met in NA and AA, and we can talk about it. You know, they say it's anonymous except for press, radio, and films, and we're on radio. But, you know, we're not members of those societies anymore, of those gentlemen's societies anymore, are we?
No.
Yeah. And we're not condemning them. They're good. They helped us. And some people in AA have told me I'm stealing because I got sober in AA and then quit going. But I do service all over the place, everywhere in the world I go. I'm walking service. You and I used to when we had 6 months or a year, year and a half sober, you and I used to take new guys out to lunch and buy them coffee and buy them lunch and talk program to them and tell them it was going to be okay. And that was something we did that was kind of fun, but some of them were really kind of scary, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, some of these guys are fresh out of the pen, you know, doing time for more than just drugs, put it that way. And
yeah, like hitting people over the head with a brick and taking their purse.
Yeah, and a lot of it's all drug-induced, so, you know, you do have a little bit of empathy for them, even though what they might have done is just absolutely vile. But, you know, when you get to – when people come to the meetings, you're not sitting there dwelling about other things other than drugs. It's really about what they did to your life and what we can do for you now. And it was interesting. Yeah. I mean, even though you and I were kind of street libertarians even then, even if we didn't call ourselves that,
we weren't there was street always, though. There was, yeah, those guys were street. There was
people were street for sure.
I remember in a meeting one time, you know, there's a thing in meetings where sometimes you'll get there early and like save a seat, you know, you'll put your chip, your 90-day chip. Oh, by the way, today is 90 days since the first time I bought some Namecoin, and I'm already like on my way to becoming the first dot bit millionaire. So I'm doing pretty well in recovery. But
I should get
my 90-day chip, my 90-day off of being only on ICANN-controlled domains today.
Well, I'll buy you another domain, but I think
7 cents, man.
I think today is my 3-year anniversary of declaring myself an anarchist. So I should hopefully get an anarchist chip from somebody. That would be nice.
Mine's I don't even like that word. I say voluntarist or ANCAP, anarcho-capitalist. I don't know.
Sure.
Anarcho-capitalist, you can say what you want, but to me, like, anarcho-capitalist, to most people, sounds like the two worst things in the world.
I know. Combined. It's almost kind of fun to say.
So I don't, yeah. It's kind of fun to irk people. Like, you know, people like Republicans that say, I'm so small government, I want to reduce the size of government till I can drown it in a bathtub. And I'm like, man, compared to you, like, compared to me, you are like FDR, man. That is so big government compared to me. And then they're just shocked. They're like, but you know, they make it a macho Republican flash thing of how small government they are. And then if you go, what about no government? They're like, the horrors, the Constitution, the Ron Pauls. Yeah. We can still get good men, top men in there and fix things. Yeah, good luck. Good luck.
Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan. Yeah, what I tell people is I'm an anarchist, but not one of those kind of anarchists. Yeah. I don't want to be violent, and I don't want to smash Starbucks windows. In fact, I like Starbucks. I like coffee. I like markets. And people are always really confused about that because they think you just want lawlessness in the street. And no, actually, that's not what I want. And not what people that think like me want either. You know, we want peace, and we just happen to not be commies, and we like money, we like free markets, and we like free people.
Yeah, free people, free markets, free everything. Thanks. Yep. So we there's a thing in the AA book. You know, I as a reader, so I studied all those books a lot, as well as working the steps, and I also studied the differences, because it's kind of interesting how NA came to be, because AA started in the 30s, and basically, it worked so well that drug addicts started going to it also. And basically, the thing in AA is it's just about alcoholics, and they think that's a special drug and different than the illegal drugs. And if you also use the illegal drugs, but you shut up about it and just talk about alcohol, they'll kind of let you stay. It's not like that anymore. Like, they've just mixed into one pot in California, especially. But there's a big difference. You know, NA started because basically AA were like, get the hell out of here. We don't want you weird junkies here. We're gentlemen. We wear suits. Go away. But they gave them their reluctant blessings to take the 12 steps and 12 traditions and start Narcotics Anonymous in the 50s. And back then, actually, you know, cops, there was a saying, once a junkie, always a junkie. And cops believed it. And cops, when NA meetings started, they would literally take the old cops would take the young cops, the rookies, drive them by the NA meeting, park and point and say, memorize every one of those faces and arrest them when you can, because they didn't believe that they could get clean, and they didn't like the idea of them congregating. It's like, it's a gang. They're powerful. Their powers are multiplied. Mm-hmm. No, they're not. They're junkies, man. And eventually, there's a story that's kind of fun. You know that guy, Frank Brennan? You remember the old guy with gray hair?
Yes.
Always wore a flower on his lapel. And he was okay with using his full name. The anonymity thing is for yourself. Like, you don't have to, is basically what it is. But you can if you don't present yourself in the media as a model citizen. And he's dead, so I can say it anyway. He was a really cool guy, and I liked him a lot. He actually helped start NA, and the story goes, and this is supposedly true, that he went to Washington, D.C. on a bus and got an appointment with J. Edgar Hoover and told J. Edgar Hoover about NA and said, this works, junkies are getting clean, please tell cops to quit busting people for going to these meetings. And allegedly, J. Edgar Hoover did it, and they stopped busting him just for trying to get clean. And this is interesting, too. That's why there are still candlelight meetings. I mean, it's kind of a meditation thing too, but they were meeting in secret.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not to mention too, I'm sure there's cops that have gone to Narcotics Anonymous meetings.
There's a higher percentage of drunk and junky cops than there are of a lot of, the general population, for sure.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
Especially alcohol, but probably drugs too, because they can get them free. And if they get caught with them in their pocket, they can say, oh, it's evidence I took off a guy and he ran and I didn't bother filling out the paperwork yet. It's legal for a cop to have some crack or heroin in his pocket, you know, basically.
Like the bad lieutenant.
The bad lieutenant. Yeah. Like, there are good. Well, maybe there are. I've heard, if there were, you know, you always hear about good cops. I'm willing to believe there are some. but I'd need to see them arrest some bad cops. And recently, a good cop tried to arrest a bad cop who was oppressing somebody, and he got in trouble for it. Did you hear about that?
No.
That's all the information I have, man. I don't know. I get so many emails. I have no idea.
Yeah.
People send me tyranny.
There's just an endless list of tyranny.
I know. And
we even try to tackle a tenth of it. We'd be here forever.
Sometimes people send me, like, try to get me to add to some mailing list of, like, be up to date on the latest police abuses. And I'm like, I don't have to do that, man. People email me that stuff all day, every day. I don't need more.
Yeah, and not to mention, too, I think a lot of your mission and a lot of people's mission in the liberty movement is to just go around that stuff. We want to bypass that stuff. We realize that sometimes we're going to have to contend with the state face to face, but by and large, we're just trying to bypass them. We don't want to engage, and we don't want to fight them head on because it's kind of a losing battle.
Yeah, man. Yep, you have to be like the little black belt in karate who just moves faster than the big opponent and gets out of his way and lets the big opponent hurt himself with his own weight.
Right.
When he tries to attack the little opponent, and the little karate guy just gets out of the way. Yeah,
right.
I mean, it's the art of war with,
yeah, it's very Sun Tzu. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very Sun Tzu combined with, grasshopper, grab this crack rock out of my hand, grasshopper.
Well, in some ways it's like, getting yourself away from the state is like getting off of drugs. It's its own addiction.
And we'll have more of that when we get back, of why statists just keep trying the same things over and over with the state and expecting different results. On Michael Dean After Dark. This is Michael Dean After Dark, hanging out with my friend Mike Makes Right. And hi, Mike.
What's up, buddy? I have something to tell you.
Go ahead, man. Tell me.
I bought something on Amazon and I did not go through your Amazon link. I'm sorry. I'm a bad person.
You are you're forgiven, my son. Was it expensive? That's what I want to know.
$80.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, if you buy like a $700 mic, I'd love it if you bought it on there, because that's a couple burritos. So right. Yeah, we were talking about recovery in San Francisco and drug addicts and how the war on drugs makes bad neighborhoods worse. So an interesting thing, I read the books and I studied them and didn't just learn from them about how to stay sober. I was really curious about about the whole system of recovery and how it works and what was wrong with it and what was right with it. I ended up writing my own book, A User's Manual for the Human Experience, which you can buy on Amazon, or you can get it from my website, michaelwdean.com, which is the website for this radio show. You can get it free as an audiobook or PDF on there. And that's kind of my book on recovery without meetings, and not just recovery from substances, but from bad people.
Right.
And
that's something, the best part of the book, by the way.
Yeah, and like after you get off drugs, you know, if you're still acting like an addict with people, you're not really recovered, I would say. But an interesting thing in the books, there's a thing in the AA book about doing service and taking, you know, newcomers out to lunch and helping them out and buying them lunch and, you know, talking program to them, talking recovery to them. And it says, you know, we always go in pairs, no matter what. We are not afraid of you, no matter how twisted you've been, which is basically saying, like, other people think you're crazy, we'll take you, we'll help you out, it doesn't matter. Interestingly, though, that thing about we're not afraid of you, no matter how twisted you've been, is nowhere in the Narcotics Anonymous literature. Now, why do you think that is?
Well, I guess if you're hopped up on goofballs and PCP, it's maybe a little bit different than just being drunk. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot of why drugs make people paranoid, I mean, they kind of do a little bit, but I think it's because they're illegal, too, and it makes people real skittish, you know? Also, a lot of people in NA have been to prison. That's not true in AA. You know, most people in AA have had a few drunk driving charges and lost their license and then gotten it back. But a lot of people in NA have been to prison, definitely for drugs, but also for doing scary things to get drugs, like violent things or, you know, crashing a car, running from the police, things like that. But that's the real scary thing is there are some people that were like really institutionalized that I met in the program, and it's because drugs are illegal. Like, I remember one time, you know, I was talking about before about how we save seats. Like, you know, you get there early and you're meeting your three friends there, and you'd get a good seat up front where you could hear the speaker really well, and there wouldn't be, you know, you're not in the back of the class with the Beavis and Buttheads who are court ordered there. And, you know, you'd put your chip down on one, you'd put your keys on another seat, and you'd put your phone on another seat and save three seats. And I did that one time at a meeting I started. Like, you know, it's not my meeting, but it's, you know, it's the meeting I started, and I went to every week, let's say that, and I knew everybody. And this guy who'd never been there before, you might remember him. He's like a white dude that was really tatted up and really right. muscular and really skinny, and had like, he was about 40. He's older than everybody there, and he had greased back hair. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's not being anonymous, but this is like 10 years ago. No one knows who I'm talking about. So this guy, like, you know, I came back from the bathroom and he was sitting in my seat, and he'd moved my phone over to the other seat. And I'm like, excuse me, that's my seat. And he's like, we don't save seats here, we save lives. Like, got up in my grill, like with his muscles poked in my chest, and said, we don't save seats, we save lives. Like, that was something he'd heard in prison probably. But yeah. It was a very prison attitude, you know? Right. And it's like, I didn't challenge him on it. I backed down. I wasn't going to get in a fight over a seat when I could sit, you know, one seat behind him and melt his brain with a resentment with my eyes.
Well, you know, there was another meeting in San Francisco, Cap Street, a very famous meeting.
Hookers and crack, man.
Yeah, you would get people literally off the street. Like, they just maybe had just turned a trick.
They would just go and fix in the bathroom. They just go shoot up in the bathroom, man, and smoke some crack.
I have to say, like, it was a refreshing place to be, as crazy as that sounds, because just when I thought I had it bad and my drug problem was terrible, I would see people that would come fresh off the streets with needles still in their arm, and they would somehow make it into a meeting. I mean, even if they got a little pamphlet or something, maybe they'd come back. You'd see them a year later, and every once in a while, you'd see somebody like that turn stuff around, and that was very encouraging.
And in the last segment of this, the redemption in the third act, we're going to talk about how we've applied that same mentality to saving people from statism and trying to help them to liberty. And, you know, I some people are like born ANCAPs. They're born stateless. But I think it's good that I used to vote and I used to be a statist, because it's like an alcoholic who's recovered is better able to help a still Nice. Suffering alcoholic than someone who's never been an alcoholic. We'll be back with more on Michael Dean After Dark.
You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, the invigorating alternative to those other late night shows.
Want to contribute to Liberty but short on cash? You can help the Freedom Fiends without even spending a post-1964 dime. Download uTorrent and start seeding Fiends episodes and DVDs to help keep us drone-proof. There's a Torrent Club link at the top of freedomfiends.com. There you'll find our Torrent RSS feed and instructions to grab past episodes and automatically download new ones, even while you're away from the computer. You'll also get special episodes of The Fiends days or even weeks before regular podcast subscribers who aren't torrenting. Leave your computer on, seeding the torrents while you're at work or asleep. The more people seeding The Fiends, the more drone-proof we'll be when the boot comes down.
Yeah, and this is Michael Dean After Dark. I'm Michael Dean. I'm talking to Mike Makes Right, and I've said, hey, how you doing, about 20 times to him, so we know how he's doing. So I want to tell a story about Cap Street, meeting, the street and the meeting, the Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and we're no longer members, so we're not breaking our anonymity. We're not on drugs. I'm coming up on 20 years sober this July.
Nice.
And you can drink like a gentleman now, but I don't drink anymore. I had problems with both, but they tell you in NA you'll die if you drink, but you didn't. You just had a problem with heroin, and now you can have a glass of wine, right?
Yep. Yeah, I think you and I both sort of broke the mold of AA. You know, we didn't listen to the fear stories very well, and somehow we're still okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you drink like a gentleman, and I haven't been to a meeting since 2006, and I'm happier and healthier and more productive than ever and still sober, so... And, like, you know, the thing I heard over and over and over in NA was, well, man, if you stay clean for like even 10 years, man, and go to meetings and stop going to meetings, man, I have three friends that put their gun in their mouth. And I'm like, I don't have a gun. I'm not going to kill him. What are you talking about? And it's like, I'm in a room with at least 7 loaded guns in it right now. Right. And the last thing I would ever do on this earth is put one in my mouth. I would never do it.
Excellent.
Yeah. So I'm all about life, man. That's why I have a bunch of guns.
Choose life. Mine.
Yeah.
Lust choose for life.
You know, I started a meeting called Lust for Life. That was the meeting where that, right. that tatted out gangbanger from Lompoc threatened to kill me because I saved my seat.
And by the way, isn't that Lust for Life a Iggy pop song where it's actually him sort of rejoicing in the fact that he's also off drugs as well?
Although so. He named it about after a book, which was later turned into a movie about Picasso, and it's anything but redemptive, that movie. That guy had a really messed up life. So this meeting... They had a they would have a Christmas, like a 48-hour meeting-a-thon at Christmas, because I guess Christmas and New Year's are times that, you know, addicts and alcoholics tend to go relapse or put their gun in their mouth. So, you know, they'd have a place to go for lonely, messed up, sober or recently sober or almost sober or barely sober people or barely clean people. And I would go there, you know, after I got clean, like, you know, my life improved a little bit. Like the gifts of recovery happened. I worked the program and things got a little better. I started having friends. I got my phone turned back on. I got a little bit of a job somewhere doing something menial. And I actually got a job at 50 Oak Street as the elevator operator in the last building in America, probably, that has an elevator operator. And it was like, I was like 31 and everybody else that worked there was like 16. So basically after getting clean at first, the only job that I was capable of doing was a part-time job that is usually assigned to teenagers. But you know, I did it better and then got a computer and then became the man I am today. Computers helped me. So helped me amplify my brain. But I went to this meeting on Christmas Day. And they had a potluck buffet, like people who were, you know, had been sober a while and had jobs would chip in and buy a roast and some turduckens and some sauce. And, you know, some people would get together and cook it and they'd bring it there and they'd have, you know, non-governmental soup kitchen, basically non-Christian, non-church, non-governmental soup kitchen and NA meetings. And it was pretty cool. And I went there with my girlfriend at the time. This is like 5-6 years later after, you know, things had gotten really good. And I had a really pretty girlfriend from Switzerland. She was kind of sheltered and she, like, I guess in Switzerland too, they have like their stolen government money healthcare actually works. You know, everyone pays like 90% taxes, but somehow they have good social services. So there really aren't like terribly, you know, fungus ridden homeless junkies there. Like the heroin's legal practically, and you can get it from the government and have clean needles in a clean room to go inject it in. So, which I'm not advocating for either, but it's better than putting a gun to someone's head and throwing them in a cage for having a habit. So I took her to this meeting and she cried. She was like, cry. Oh. We were like,
oh, she wasn't in the program.
No. And we were like, we were dull. She was a normie. She smoked.
You took her to Cap Street.
I took her to Cap Street for Christmas, man. Like I was like, you know, I go do this service. I go help the people who helped me and it, you know, you pay it back. And then those people maybe get sober and help someone else the next year. And you know, let's go down to Christmas and do some charity work for our friends. And she's like, oh, this sounds very good to me. You know, I mean, I think she pictured people who were a little down on their luck and maybe lost their job and, you know, were living in their car. But these were like people who had, you know, they were living under somebody else's car, basically.
Right. Right.
She cried, man, which is not funny. It's kind of touching, but it's like that's kind of the place. This is where we got sober is what we're saying, is a place that would make normal people with normal emotions and cares cry.
Right. Well, it also puts it into some crazy perspective because she probably never saw anything so
wretched
and sad in her whole life.
Yeah.
And she probably still remembers that. She probably still tells her friends and family about that.
Yeah. Yes. Like, America, it is horrible. My boyfriend took me to this place to help these people who were so wretched. Wretched and brutish, brutalized. Yeah,
it truly was a scary place, though. I mean, we're not embellishing this place in the slightest.
The interesting thing is, you know, they talk in NA about how narcotics made you seek lower companionship. That place was lower. The place I went to get clean was lower than any place or the people I used with. You know, I wasn't a junkie for that long. I was an alcoholic for a number of years and then cured my alcoholism with daily injections of intravenous narcotics. I don't recommend that plan, but it does cure your alcoholism. You don't drink anymore.
Right.
And yeah, so, you know, but I don't know, I guess I'm a smart guy. I'm not saying I could have maintained that forever, because obviously I wasn't, and I got sober. Like, literally, I think in LibPair, where you could buy heroin in a vending machine, as long as it was, you know, privately owned and operated, I think there would still be NA, because there's still AA, and AA you can buy on any street, you know, alcohol you can buy on any street corner. So
right.
It's not right. Just because it's illegal and really expensive and really cut with a lot of stuff and you get infections. That's not the only thing that drives people to recovery. It's just really right. Boring to be a junkie, man. It's the most boring thing in the world after a while.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the flip side, there would be no desperation. I mean, people used to go to Polk Street in San Francisco and do things that they would never do to get their fix.
It'd be like being on insulin, you know? I mean, people don't commit prostitution. People right. don't become prostitutes or break into houses to get insulin.
Isn't that interesting? It's just the big negative externality in the room is the state. And, you know, we could mitigate so much of this crazy drug problem that America has. We could take a large portion of the criminal element away from this domain. Yet, you know, they think that directly intervening is somehow going to make the problem better. Well, we've seen decades and decades of that not being true. And you and I have seen it with our own eyes that's not true at all.
Yeah, it's really not.
It's really sad.
And I want to talk a little bit about the people in recovery and how so many that we met in San Francisco were so statist and so liberal statist. And
yeah.
I think part of it is because, like you said, San Francisco, you know, caters to and coddles people who could probably work but don't. I mean, I remember actually, I'm not going to tell that story. That's funnier than if I told the story, actually. Just, I can't tell that on radio. So, you know, basically, people get paid to be sober. And there's this thing, some comedian, I don't know if it's Louis C.K. or somebody, like, was talking about, like, how everyone cheers you when you say you've got 30 days sober and hold up your chip. And it's like, you know, he's like, where's my chip? You know, I've never gotten drunk and been a butthole. You know, I've always been nice. I've never had a drinking problem. Where's my slap on the back and my cake?
Right.
You know,
like you have to do something bad first before somebody will like you.
Oh yeah. Cause you know, I mean, that's kind of like the whole victim mentality. Like, you know, the worse you were, the better your recovery story sounds, whether it's drugs or abuse or whatever, or crime, you know, anything that makes a good story. Cause it's a three act story. It's, you know, first act, second act, redemption in the third act. And you have to go to hell to get to heaven. Cause that's a good story. And then right. you end up on Oprah and then they find out you lied and made the whole thing up. And really you did not, you know, do things with men in bus stations for your drugs. You actually just did a bong hit and fell off your skateboard and walked into an AA meeting to get Band-Aid, and they invited you in and were really nice to you, so you stayed because you were a pretty right. girl named Shada. Yeah. I made that up.
Nice.
So yeah, there's a whole kind of like they pay you to, you know, if you get off drugs in San Francisco, like they'll pay you to go to college. And this is like 20 years ago, man. This isn't Obamacare. This is like, you know, well, it's actually like Nancy Pelosi care, because wasn't she like the state senator back then? And
she was.
Was Feinstein was the mayor.
Yeah. And another thing about
how they breed these politicians,
the recovery process, the 12-step recovery process, people have always claimed that it's culty, and it kind of is. And it does sort of dovetail into people's worship of the state. You get the same kind of, you know, without X, you know, there'll be chaos in the streets. And there's, like you were saying, that there's a lot of people who are in recovery who are just the worst type of statist. And I've seen it. I mean, granted, our experiences is, you know, N equals two, but I think that sort of makes it worse if you've already got that. You're in that AA cult, and you're really in the culty part of the AA, not so much the recovery part. And then you happen to be a statist. You're usually one of the worst kind.
AA is also really 12-step programs in general are also really big on giving you things to parrot and getting pats on the back for emulating the thoughts of other people. And that kind of works with recovery because literally, like, they've got it down. They've figured out how to do it in a way that works for people who were constitutionally incapable of doing it any other way. But
right.
That also leads to when, you know, people say, oh, well, let's go get coffee afterwards. Okay, let's go to the Obama rally afterwards. And people want acceptance. Right. And it's like what the cool people are doing. And all the cool kids are doing it, man. All the cool kids are voting. And it's like these people used to be hitting people over the head with a brick. And I say that because I actually heard people say that. Like I heard a guy say, I used to have a gun and I mugged people with it to get my drug money. And then I sold my gun because I needed drug money one day and I was too weak to go, you know, mug somebody. And then, you know, I still had a knife, so I'd go mug people with my knife. And then I had to sell my knife. And it got to the point where all I had to rob people with was hitting them over the head with a brick. So actually, these people did more damage when they got rid of their gun. Because they never shot anybody. They just pulled the gun on people and scared them, or the knife. But then they got rid of those and they had to use a brick and actually hit somebody. So, yeah, man, guns should be legal for drug addicts in San Francisco. I'm kidding.
The thing is that I've seen similarities in the way people will in NA meeting or AA meetings, they'll recite a prayer or they'll recite a response, and it's very rote and very robotic, and it's just like saying the Pledge of Allegiance. There's a lot of similarities there. It's kind of creepy.
We'll be back with the redemption in the third act. On Michael Dean After Dark's tour of the Tenderloin with Mike Bixright. You're listening to Michael Dean After Dark, and yes, we're broadcasting this message into space. Yeah, this is Michael Dean After Dark. This is Michael Dean, and we got Mike Makes Right, and this is the redemption in the third act. Mike, why don't you tell me how we can apply the gifts of recovery and the idea of one person, one peer who's been where the other person's trying to go, one person talking to another without judgment, how that method of getting people off drugs and alcohol can get people off statism and love of the state and thinking that they need men with guns to enforce pure things.
Well, we got to show them, you know, there's that old song, show and tell. That's the game I play when I want to say I love you. And really it's, we can't really tell people about the message. We have to show them. And the best way I know how is to let people know that I am a libertarian and I am somebody who rejects the state, and I stick my neck out there and I let other people know that it's okay to do that too. I know it's scary. A lot of times it's like coming out. It's almost as if you're gay and you're coming out to your crazy Christian parents. You know, it's you might actually be an anarchist at heart, but you can't for whatever reason. Just know that there's other people out there, and for me and you, I can't speak for other libertarians, but you know, you and I will have them. We'll bring you in. You know, we'll buy you lunch. We'll talk with you. You know, we might not agree with everything you say, but or anything you say, but at least you'll get it out there. You'll hear yourself talk about the state. You'll hear the propaganda come out of your mouth, and hopefully, that might get the wheel spinning in your head.
Yeah. Somebody's emailing me from San Francisco right now and asking me if I know why it's called the Tenderloin. And yeah,
we covered that already.
We covered that. So how else can we help people help themselves away from the state so they can really help themselves?
Well, they have to take a look at some of the institutions that are propping up some of the new technology. Bitcoin, of course. If you don't know about Bitcoin, geez, where have you been living for the past 4 years? But find out about it. Find out about ways to bypass the state. You don't have to fight it. You don't have to smash it. You just have to work around it. It's like an annoying – you've got Microsoft Word open and you can't do something. You keep going to that menu and for whatever reason it's not working. Well, there's another way to do that. Whatever you're trying to
prompt.
Yeah,
the command prompt of freedom instead of the GUI of statism. Prompt,
or we should say the terminal to make the Linux people happy.
I think it's called a terminal with some people in Windows. You know, that's what a command prompt is.
I love Linux people, by the way. They're always so funny. Like, I don't understand why you need a GUI. Just open up a terminal and type in get install update slash.
I'll say this. You know, Linux people who think they're better than everyone else are annoying, but they're actually right. Whereas Mac people who think they're better than PC, that's like a Democrat saying, I'm better than you because I'm not a Republican. You know, it's right. Really Linux is the libertarian. Mac totally. Is the Democrat. PC is the Republican. So you really can't argue. And actually, I already covered this on Freedom Fiends today in my slap fight with Derek J. So, you know, he's going to be on this show. So this show is going to be Sunday through Thursday or Monday through Friday, depending on what time zone you're in. And it's going to be different rotating co-hosts, spinning corrals of co-hosts, one at a time with me. And it's going to be on LRN, and it's going to be on GCN. It's going to be on some radio stations. So tell two friends and tell me some final cool stuff there, Mike. Because you're not coming back. You said you don't want to be the bass player to Squisgar.
To the Joe Satriani band.
Yeah.
No, I'll just stay in the pocket and play the bass. But yeah, what it comes down to is that whatever I'm saying, it's definitely I don't claim to have an original thought. You know, people have said it way better than I have in the past, and I think there's better voices out there for liberty than myself. I just try to help the people that are near me and around me, and I let them know I'm not confrontational, but I let them know that I am an anarchist and I'm not afraid, and that I reject the state, and you can too.
Peacefully. No matter how,
You don't have to be violent about it, and it's not that scary.
You don't even have to be mean about it. You're mellow about it. Some people are mean and oppressive about it, but
and
we're mellow.
Not to mention, we have better cookies, too. So
yeah, we have better cookies. We have better coffee than NA.
Right.
All right, man. Thank you, Mike.
All right, brother.
Stick around for a little post-show for the real party.
Oh, yeah.
This has been Michael Dean After Dark. I hope we've helped calm the hamster in your brain and left you in a better place than where we found you. We'll be here 5 nights a week, same time and channel. In the meantime, go to michaelwdean.com for more. That's michaelwdean.com. Thank you and have a wonderful evening. Good night.